I invite you to turn in the scriptures to 1 Samuel chapter 16. This is page 282 in the church Bible. We'll look at the first 13 verses of 1 Samuel 16. Hear now God's holy, inspired, and inerrant word. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse, the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons." Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me." The Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord,' and invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. You shall anoint for me him whom I declare to you." Samuel did what the Lord commanded and came to Bethlehem. The elders of the city came to meet him trembling and said, "Do you come peaceably?" And he said, "Peaceably. I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." He consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. When they came, he looked on Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." Then Jesse called Avinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Then Jesse made Shammah pass by, and he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel, and Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen these." Then Samuel said to Jesse, "Are all your sons here?" He said, "There remains yet the youngest, but behold, he's keeping the sheep." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Send and get him, for we will not sit down till he comes here." He sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. The Lord said, "Arise, anoint him, for this is he." Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. The Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward. Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. Well, that's your interpretation. It's not mine. I could wish for a dollar every time I had that. I have heard that since college. I would be filthy rich. It's usually meant to create an impenetrable barrier between what one person is saying and what another person is believing. And nothing can be allowed to challenge unbelief in their minds, because there is no truth that crosses any barriers between one person and another, except, of course, that one. But even postmodernism is now being discarded in favor of cultural Marxism and the language of power. Enter the relevance of this text, even and maybe especially in such a context. Marxism divides everyone up into classes of people. The people who were oppressed now take power for themselves. And for Marxists, language is all about power. It's not about logic. It's not about consistency. You can tell them till you're blue in the face that their worldview doesn't make any sense, and they don't care. It's about power. If we can rephrase the original context and the original quotation, "That's your interpretation," to fit a Marxist context, it would look like this. If you're a straight white male, your opinion means absolutely nothing. It's still, though, a matter of perspective, isn't it? The difference, though, is that the postmodern believes all views are equally valid, at least he says he believes that, whereas the Marxist believes that only oppressed voices are valid. What we're going to see here in chapter 16 is that in reality, only God's perspective really matters in the end. Now Saul has disqualified himself from the kingship. Samuel is in mourning over him, as we saw at the end of chapter 15, as if Saul is already dead. Samuel isn't just mourning over Saul. He's concerned over the state of Israel, whether Israel will disintegrate because Saul is no longer part of the picture. And the Lord tells Samuel to get going, because the Lord has provided for himself a king over all Israel. Well, Samuel's immediately concerned about that. He's worried that if Saul finds out, he'll kill Samuel for being a traitor. And so the Lord provides protection for Samuel in the form of concealment. Lots of people have written about this passage with various views. Some of them even going so far as to say that the Lord was lying for Samuel's sake. Is he instructing Samuel to lie? The answer is absolutely not. The Lord provides a secondary purpose for Samuel's trip that Samuel can use as a legitimate reason for going to Bethlehem. The Lord never asks Samuel to lie. Samuel does, in fact, offer the sacrifice. So here we learn, of course, that concealing part of the truth is not the same thing as a lie, particularly when one is not under oath to tell the whole truth or have no other obligation to tell the whole truth. The Lord did not tell Samuel that he had to tell Saul everything. Samuel took the heifer in order to offer a sacrifice. He indeed offered a sacrifice. There is no lie here, contrary to what many liberal scholars like to think. In fact, it's so bad among liberal scholars that one wonders if these scholars who think God is lying are saying that in order to justify their own lies about the text. But the next question that we might ask is, why are the elders of the town trembling when Samuel gets there? What's got them so afraid? Well, that has almost certainly to do with word getting around of how Samuel had just executed Agag the Amalekite, and how Samuel was also opposed to Saul. That was a very public confrontation that Samuel had with Saul. And these people were presumably still loyal to Saul, so there was no telling what Samuel might do to people who were loyal to Saul. They thought Samuel was a violent person. Well, having consecrated Jesse and his sons in Bethlehem, Samuel starts looking at Jesse's sons and tries to guess which of Jesse's sons will be anointed king, tries to read the divine mind. And in so doing, we have the first hint that this passage is really all about perception. Samuel looks at the oldest son of Jesse, Eliab, and thought, this is surely the one that the Lord wants to make king. It's obvious. But look at Eliab's description. He's tall, isn't he? The Lord tells him, don't look on his appearance or on the height of his stature. He's too much like Saul, in other words. We're going to see that in chapter 17. His view of what David did in the Goliath story is very similar to what Saul's going to say. He's just too much like Saul. The Lord wants someone different from all the nations around him, around Israel. But Eliab was not going to be different. Samuel, in other words, had perception problems. Even Samuel had problems. Not even Samuel could be fully trusted to find the man who is after the Lord's own heart. Only God could do that. Fortunately for Samuel, the Lord explains himself quite clearly in verse 7, and the qualifications that had impressed Samuel and which were Saul's characteristics in abundance were not the qualifications for leadership that the Lord was looking for. Doesn't mean the Lord was looking for someone who was ugly. It means that the outward appearance for the Lord is simply irrelevant to leadership. It's certainly not irrelevant for most people today. In one of the most important books written in the last century, Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, he notes that we've become a visual culture with the advent of the television. The switch happened during the Nixon-Kennedy debates. And a fascinating thing happened during the polling after the debate. Nixon had gotten in late the night before and was looking very disheveled. Kennedy, however, had had plenty of time to look and dress the part. Those who only heard the debate said by a majority that Nixon had won because he had the better arguments, but those who had seen the debate said in a majority that Kennedy had won the debate because he looked the part better. How many people voted for Bill Clinton because he looked better than the elder Bush and Ross Perot in the first election, better than Bob Dole in the next election? Perception was important in those elections and continues to be important. Isn't it the case that if a candidate doesn't look presidential, he's not even considered electable? But the Lord doesn't see things that way, does he? He explicitly tells Samuel here, the outward appearance is irrelevant. We know that ugliness is not a qualification for leadership. David is hardly ugly, but it is irrelevant to God's concerns on the front of leadership. Looking the part does not mean the person is qualified to lead. Rather, the Lord looks on the heart. And the example of Jesus makes this perfectly plain as well. Isaiah 53, verse 2, says this about Jesus. For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. Jesus' personal appearance was not like Saul, and it was not like Eliab, but in him the Father was well pleased. In verse 4 of that chapter, the human perception about Jesus is laid out plain. We esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. In other words, our perception of Jesus didn't match what the Father's perception of Jesus is. Well, guess which perception mattered more in the end? Guess which perception should bend in obedience to the other? Well, in application of that principle, when we contemplate ourselves, our worth, our value, whose perspective is going to matter most? Our modern culture tells us that we are who we believe ourselves to be. The definition of humanity is self-definition, a psychological self-definition, in fact. That's the foundation for the transgender movement, in fact. But is it a solid foundation? Well, we ask ourselves this question. If a potter makes a pot, does the pot have the right to say what it is for? Or does the potter have the right to say what that pot is for? Obviously, the potter does. And any artist would say the same. In our case, we are who God has declared us to be. That is the definition of human. That is the definition of our identity. We are who God has declared us to be. Now, not only is this important to keep in mind with regard to our identity as humans, But it's just as important, if not more so, when we consider salvation itself, because it is God who declares us to be innocent in Jesus Christ in our justification before God. And that constitutes us a new people of God in Christ. And that is who we are. The major objection, of course, today is that no one is allowed to speak for God, if he even exists. And surely it's arrogant of anyone to claim to speak for God. Well, that would only be true if God had not revealed himself to humanity, both in nature and in Scripture. But if he has revealed himself in both of those places, then there is, in fact, nothing at all arrogant in saying that God has said what he has said. In fact, it's actually the height of arrogance to say the opposite. Because then the speaker, in saying that no one can speak for God, he's pitting himself against God. And he's claiming that his own perspective is really more important and truthful than God's own revelation. We saw that Saul had already done that by declaring his own will more important than God's will in chapter 15. We have to remember then that God sees the human heart. Nothing can be concealed from him. This is not only true of individuals, but it's also true of churches. So churches are what God declares them to be. And we should not be fooled by outward appearances with regard to the church either. William Blakey has this marvelous thing to say about the church. Let everything be outwardly correct, the church beautiful, the music excellent, the sermon able, the congregation numerous and respectable. What a pattern such a church is often regarded as being. Alas, how little satisfactory it may be to God. The eye that searches and knows us penetrates to the heart. It is there only that God finds the genuine elements of worship, the lowly sense of personal unworthiness, the wondering contemplation of the divine love, the eager longing for mercy to pardon and grace to help, the faith that grasps the promises, the hope that is anchored within the veil, the kindness that breathes benediction all around, the love that beareth all things. It is these things breathing forth from the hearts of a congregation that gives pleasure to God. Perception is important when it comes to God's perception. He has said, the last shall be first, and the first shall be last. Eliav is the firstborn. He's passed over despite looking the part of the king magnificently. It's the youngest child of all, the lowly shepherd David. Jesse says, oh yeah, there remains the youngest, but he's keeping the sheep. He's not king material, is he? He's the one who's anointed king. You see, perception on our part has the habit of making us look at everything upside down. We tend to want to see things oppositely to how God does. Consider this little thought experiment. Write up in your mind a list of the 50 most important Christians since the founding of the church at Pentecost. And then imagine that God has a list of the 50 most important people in the church since the founding of Pentecost. And then ask yourself if there will be any overlap whatsoever between those two lists. Our lists would probably have famous and well-known churchmen and theologians like Augustine and Luther and Calvin. But has it ever occurred to us that God's list might very well consist entirely of people we have never even heard of, because they were the best prayer warriors that the church ever had, praying in the closet, doing things that weren't even visible in the history of the church. Well, prayer warriors don't get much, if any, credit in this life, but I can assure you they will in the next life. What matters then is God's opinion and perspective. We need to bend our opinion to match God's and be constantly open to being corrected on everything related to perspective. Because you see, the more our opinions bend to God's opinion, the more godly we will be, the more we'll love God, the more we'll love our neighbor, and the more we will be compassionate towards those who do not yet see or value God's perception.